Stand by for the Terry Saul Show in 5. Roll tape. 4. Cue Terry. 3. Bring audio up. 2. Stand by. 1. Play intro.
Stay tuned for the Terry Saul Show on Salem's original radio station, 104.3 FM and 1220 AM, KSLM. Today's show is being brought to you by the Lule Group, featuring Lule's Car Connection, Don Lule Homes, and Teresa Lule's State Farm Insurance.
Good morning and welcome to the Terry Saul Show on Salem's original radio station, KSLM AM and FM. I am your host and I'm so glad today that you join us. My special guest is a very good friend of mine, Captain Richard Chesbro from the Willamette Queen Sternwheeler. But today we're going to talk about his adventures around the world. Hello, how are you?
Good morning.
How long have I known you?
Patty
and I were trying to
figure out. Almost 20 years,
yeah,
I guess.
I think about 20 years.
Yep.
Yeah, and you still keep coming back for more, don't you?
I know.
Remember
when that's because you put up with me.
when I was over at the other radio station across town, there we'd do these interviews every week. We used to get phone calls from people that thought I was so mean to you and would pick on you.
And you were.
You're right.
Yep.
You're right. But your wife told me that after a while, they started calling your office saying, why do you keep sending Richard down there? That guy's so mean to him. Jeez.
I love the abuse.
There you go. How are you, sir?
I'm great. I'm great.
How are you getting through this pandemic? You doing okay with it? You've had your shots. You have both of them, haven't you?
I've had both shots.
Yeah.
And yes, I'm in the clear as far as the vaccine is concerned.
Yeah. Did you, when I had my shot just a few days ago, Patty brought me a Reese's peanut butter cup because I didn't cry afterwards.
Mm-hmm.
And I go, what's that for? She goes, well, you didn't cry, so here's your treat. Well, that's good. Thank you. I didn't even feel the shot, Richard. She stuck that needle in, and as she was pulling it out, she goes, okay, the worst part's over. And I go, what do you mean? She goes, we're done. I go, seriously? It just didn't. And my arm was a little bit sore. I had it on my right side for a reason, because I knew I would sleep on my left side. That way I wouldn't have to see Patty all night long.
Ah, mm-hmm. Good idea.
No, it wasn't.
It wasn't.
Not when I told her why.
Oh.
But it's been a wild year with this COVID thing, hasn't it?
Pandemic. It's been a wild year. And yeah. From a financial standpoint, as a operator of a business that is basically a restaurant on the water,
right.
It's been devastating. You know,
yeah. You had to build something in the back there of the boat for a while, didn't you?
We did. When we were allowed to have outside seating,
yeah.
Then we closed in our rear deck and also the foredeck on the lower deck so that we could at least have small groups, six, 12. You know, 10 people in that category. So that was a little bit of a breather. And now we're at 25% capacity on the inside for inside seating.
Yeah.
And hopefully we have our fingers crossed. The governor is going to be announcing some more.
Soon.
She might relax those restrictions a little bit more, which would be great. Because we've got a number of weddings that we've got booked. One actually coming up this weekend. That we have to, you know, cut back the numbers for.
Right.
But if we can get a loosen up of the restrictions, then.
Okay. How long have you been into boating?
Oh, my goodness. Probably since my college years.
They had college back then?
They, yes, they did.
That lady's going to start calling right up here.
In fact, let me give her your
yeah,
number,
that's right.
Your private number.
That's 1-800-CALL-SOMEONE-ELSE.
My dad always had a boat, and so even as kids growing up, we often would spend the weekend going. We lived in Massachusetts, and would go out to Cape Cod and, you know, Gloucester, Marblehead, places like that, and we'd put the boat in the water and go out fishing for the day.
Right.
We even had a couple of lobster pots, so we'd put those out as well.
Nice.
Great memories. With my dad.
One of the reasons I asked you to come in today was because I want to talk about some of your experiences. You've actually traveled around the world, and not by airplane.
Nope, by water.
How many times have you done that?
Well, I've made two long trips. I guess if you put the two trips together, it would equal basically going around the world.
Right.
The first trip, we figured we covered about 23,000 miles.
Really? Now, when did you do that?
That was in 1973.
Okay.
That's when we left with the moon mist.
Is that like the little rowboat you had?
The little rowboat.
Yeah, a little bit bigger than a rowboat?
A 47-foot rowboat, yeah.
Really?
But no, it was a sailboat.
Okay, so wait, let's go through this step by step. So you decided that this 47-foot sailboat, you and who went with you?
My wife and my three kids.
Okay, how old were the kids? Were they under?
The kids were 12, 10, and 9.
Okay, so they're young kids.
Yeah.
All right. And did you decide at that point you were going to go around the world, or what was the original plan?
Well, the original plan was just to go to Hawaii and back.
Would you make a wrong turn?
Well, the problem was right at the last minute, both my wife's family, you know, her parents and my parents, dug their heels in and refused to allow us to take the kids with us on that first leg, only because we hadn't done it before. Both of us had all the confidence in the world in our own abilities, and the boat was well equipped. I wasn't going to cause a big fight between us and our parents.
Right.
So we left the kids behind. The trip to Hawaii was absolutely beautiful, and we took other adults with us.
I was going to say, did you have a crew with you or something?
We had a crew, absolutely.
Of about how many?
Three other
guys. So there's three guys, and then you and your wife. So there's five on this thing?
Five all total.
There's not a road map to get to Hawaii. How do you know how to get to Hawaii when you're out there in the ocean there?
Well, you navigate. And at that time, they didn't have celestial navigation. I mean, navigation with instruments, you know, like the satellite nav systems like we do today.
Right.
So,
like a GPS.
Like GPS.
Okay.
They had Loran, but Loran is only good for about 200 miles offshore, and then it just disappears. It's non-existent.
Okay, so you get out there, you're 200 miles offshore on your way to, hopefully, Hawaii.
Right.
What are you doing? Are you following the stars, the sun, the moon? What do you do?
Well, one of the guys that came with us was a navigator, and that was the main reason we said, yep, you're on board. You know, we weren't paying anybody, but they were all doing it for the adventure and just, and I promised him I'd get him an airplane ticket to fly him back after we got to Hawaii. And so we totally put our navigation capabilities in the hands of this one young man. I won't mention his name, but he didn't really tell us the whole story about his navigational capabilities.
He had no clue where the hell he was going, did he?
He had no clue. He navigated in an airplane. Totally different type of a navigation system than navigating on the water.
Right.
And he had never used a sextant before. And I had a sextant on board.
What is that?
It's an instrument that you use to measure the height of a celestial body from the horizon. And you do that with different celestial bodies, and it gives you what they call
such as
the sun, the moon, or stars.
Okay.
He knew the basic concepts of all this. Extremely intelligent man. His name was Alan, and I had all the books and everything there. Just I had never had a chance to take the course in celestial navigation, because we were putting the trip together and wanted to get underway before the hurricane season hit. And
good idea,
a very good idea. So
where did you leave out? Did you leave out of? Did you leave out of
San Pedro?
Okay,
in Los Angeles.
Okay,
the boat was actually in Marina del Rey, which is a huge yacht harbor in Los Angeles.
So what supplies did you put? I mean, how long did you think it was going to take you to go to Hawaii?
Well, we figured about 20 to 22 days.
Okay.
We made it 19, so we did very well.
So what kind of supplies are you packing for 20 days worth out of the sea?
Obviously, you just have to figure out what are you going to eat, how many people per day, you know, three meals a day, snacks and all that stuff. My wife, my first wife at the time, was very good at estimating what we needed to have. Some of the guys brought their own special little treats, things that they like, like you mentioned, Reese's Peanut Butter Cups or whatever, you know.
Were you traveling 24 hours a day? I mean, you're out there on the water. At nighttime, do you stop?
No. No.
Well, who's steering the boat?
Well, you work shifts. We had what they call watches, and a watch was a four-hour shift.
Okay.
And that means you and one more person were on duty during that time, and the rest of the crew could be asleep.
Why do you have to have two on duty in case one takes a nap?
Falls over.
That's what I was wondering.
Yes.
Now, is your boat lit at night? I mean, when you're out there in the middle of nowhere.
The boat is lit at night. We have running lights because you don't want to get run over by a ship or anything else. Another reason for having two people on board is you get two sets of eyes keeping an eye out, so that nothing sneaks up on you.
What, like an iceberg?
No, not an iceberg, because we were obviously pretty close to the equator.
Yeah, being a wise guy, okay.
Yeah, I know.
So what would sneak up on you?
Well, mainly other boats. We were sailing in the what they call the rum line going over to Hawaii, which is the shortest distance, and therefore any boat traffic, like freighters or even passenger vessels.
Did you see any of them?
We did. We saw a number of them. We saw other yachts like ours. In fact, we stopped one of them because For some reason, one of the guys on board was just dying for some ice cream. And so we called these people up. As soon as we saw them, we hailed them on our radio telephone and started talking. And, of course, the subject of ice cream had to come up. And the other boat said, oh, yeah, we have a freezer on board. We got some ice cream. You want some ice cream? What do you want to trade for it? And believe it or not, they offered them my wife, the only female we had on board. They said, well, we'll let you borrow her for a while if you want. Give us some ice cream. And they said, good deal. And of course, she didn't even realize that was what the deal was. So
okay,
that was
that's why that she's your ex-wife. That's why she's a former wife.
She is a former wife.
Uh-huh.
But it was all in fun and games. And yeah. She did go over and visit him, and she cooked a meal for the guys on the other boat. They were all guys.
So how do you get the boat? You're out in the middle of the ocean there,
yeah.
and you get close enough that you can, I mean, you don't want to get too close because you don't want to bump into each other.
Well, we had fenders, and we did. We actually tied the two boats together.
Really?
And hove to. In other words, we dropped our sails and just basically idling, you know, just staying together. The weather was absolutely gorgeous almost all the way over.
Did you have a motor on this boat?
Oh, sure. Yeah, we had a motor. Being a sailboat, it didn't have a huge capacity of fuel.
Okay.
So we were very hesitant to use the motor because you always want to save that for when you really need it.
Right.
And when we got into the doldrums, we were absolutely without wind for five days. Finally, after about the third day of not moving an inch, I mean, you could throw a can or something over the side of the boat, and the next morning it would still be sitting right alongside of the boat.
Wow.
So we finally, you know, powered up and burned some fuel to get out of it and find the wind again.
Okay, so then all of a sudden, land ahoy, there it is. You see Hawaii.
And you know who the happiest person was to see the Diamond Head come into over the horizon?
Who was that?
The navigator, Alan. He was jumping around like a crazy man. You know, we couldn't figure out why he was so ecstatic. And that's when he told
realized
us
that
he wasn't sure that he was doing it right, you know, with all of his calculations.
Yeah.
And I'd often thought, I said, boy, he seems to be putting a lot of time into this, you know. I mean, he was constantly shooting different, you know, bodies in the sky and working all the math. And I mean, it's a pretty complicated process to do it all by hand.
Right.
Nowadays, of course, they have onboard computers that are the size of your cell phone.
Right.
That do it all automatically. Yeah.
So you get into Hawaii. Were your kids over there waiting for you when you got there? Or?
No. We flew them over. We weren't sure exactly when we were going to arrive.
Okay.
And so I actually went back and got them and brought them back with me.
Okay.
Because I also had some equipment I had to bring back for the boat.
So now you're in Hawaii. You're deciding where we're going to go from here?
We unfortunately ran into too many delays with stuff we had to do on the boat. And so the hurricane season came upon us.
Okay.
And in Hawaii. So we ended up having to spend like, I don't know, 9 months in Hawaii.
Oh, that must have been rough.
Oh, it was horrible.
Yeah.
We put the kids into school, and I mean, it was obviously a fantastic time.
Sure.
We sailed between all the islands, and when you're on your own boat, you know, you're not dealing with hotel rooms, you're not dealing with airplanes and schedules, and so we could come and go as we pleased, and if we liked an island location, like, for example, Lahaina pops to mind on the island of Maui. Fell in love with that little harbor.
Mm-hmm.
And so we just stayed there longer than we anticipated, but we were just having such a great time.
And you slept on the boat and you just lived on the boat.
Yeah, yeah. The boat was It was home. It was where we cooked, where we took showers, where we did everything.
All right, we need to take a short break. When we come back, I want to talk to you about going into some areas where there's pirates, and also you went swimming with some sharks.
Yes, we
did.
Not
a smart thing to do, but what the heck? You're listening to the Terry Saul Weekend Show on Salem's original radio station, 104.3 FM and 1220 AM. This is KSLM. We're talking with Captain Richard Chesbro about his excursion around the world in a boat. Back in a minute.
Just sit right back and you'll hear a tale of a fateful trip that started from this tropic point aboard this tiny ship. Mate was a mighty sailing man, skipper brave and sure. Five passengers set sail that day for a three-hour tour. The weather started getting rough, the tiny ship was tossed.
You're listening to The Terry Saul Show on KSLM AM and FM, brought to you today by the Lule Group.
Wow. We're back in 5, 4, Q Terry, 2, 1, you're on.
You're listening to The Terry Saul Show on KSLM AM and FM. Brought to you today by the Lule Group.
Just sit right back and you'll hear a tale of a fateful trip that started from this tropic point aboard this tiny ship. The mate was a mighty sailing man, skipper brave and sure. Five passengers set sail that day for a 3-hour tour.
Welcome back to the Terry Saul Weekend Show. My guest is my buddy Richard Chesbrough from the Willamette Queen Sternwheeler. And we're talking about the fact that he and his first wife and grabbed the kids and says, hey, we're going to go for a ride. Happened to be on a 47-foot boat. He started heading around the world. So when we last talked, you just landed in Hawaii. You had to stay there for 9 months. Where did you decide you were going to go from there?
We were in a marina where there were a lot of other yacht people. I was going around talking to different guys about their experiences. What part of, you know, beyond where we were did they most enjoy? We kind of plotted out our course, and we wanted to head first to the Marquesas Islands.
Where's that?
And it's also in the South Pacific.
Okay.
It's a tough sail from Hawaii because you're actually almost dead into the wind, you know, going in that direction, which means you're going to be heeled over. It's going to be an uncomfortable, you know, cruise. It's not like sailing with the wind behind you. Everybody told us it's well worth it. You know, you'll really enjoy it. It's about an 8 or 9 day sail from Hawaii. Okay. And so that was our first destination.
Everything went smooth on there?
It was all that they said it was. It was a tough sail. When you're constantly 24 hours a day standing on a deck that's at a, you know, 35, 40 degree angle, it gets a little uncomfortable after a while, you know.
And this is fun for you, right?
It was. Well, you just get used to it, you know. Yeah, when in Rome, do as the Romans do. The boat performed beautifully, and we made it to the Marquesas. And by the way, I will add, we didn't need a navigator from Hawaii on, because both my wife and I took classes in celestial navigation. We learned ourselves how to do all of that.
Okay. So you moved on to there. How long did you stay in that area?
In the Marquesas?
Yeah.
Oh, boy, probably about a month.
Okay.
Went to, you know, there's various islands that we went to. And every place we went, these islanders just welcome you with open arms.
Really?
They're so happy to see somebody from the outside world. I don't know to this day, but I don't think there's any air service at all into these islands. They're so small, but people live on them.
Would you trade with the locals?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. And I was prepared for that. Some of the folks told us when we were in Hawaii what were good trade items.
Okay.
Things like T-shirts and ball caps and fishing gear. 22 bullets, believe it or not, were a hot item. I mean, one little box of 22 shells, you know, they'd feed you for a week.
Really?
Oh, yeah.
Wow.
Because the French islands, the French government does not allow them. They allow them to have a 22 rifle and one box of shells for a whole year. And so needless to say, and they hunt pig and all kinds of wild animals with that 22 rifle. But to have an extra box of shells was like, you know, wonderful.
Here's an extra box, but don't say nothing to nobody.
Exactly, yeah. Okay.
So from there, where did you go?
From the Marquesas Islands, we went to the Tuamotus Islands. The Tuamotus are very interesting because, unlike the Marquesas, which have mountain peaks and, you know, hills and valleys, the Tuamotus Islands are flat as a pancake. And, I mean, they're just literally just barely above the water sea level. They also have reefs all around the island, like an atoll, and it's shaped like a horseshoe with only one entrance going in and one entrance coming out.
Really?
So it was challenging. You don't see them until you're almost on top of them. So our navigation had to be right on the money.
So at this point, it's you and your wife, and were the kids with you at this point?
Oh, yes.
And there was, what, 3 children?
3 children.
Okay. Did you have any crew people with you as well?
No. Oh, wait a minute. Yes, we had Ian with us. Right at the last minute, this young man came along, and he was just hitchhiking rides. And he was from South Africa, probably in his early 20s, could speak like 5 or 6 languages, knew just about everything you'd want a crew member to know, including navigation, including first aid, because he'd been, ever since he graduated high school, his father gave him a $100 bill, and told him, he says, I've given you all the skills you could possibly need to get by traveling by boat. So go see the world. And he was still on that trip to see the world, and he had wonderful stories, but the kids absolutely loved him.
Was there any point that anybody got sick or any kind of illness or something? I mean, what do you, when you're out in the middle of nowhere and all you see is water everywhere you look, all of a sudden you come down with a fever or something, what do you do?
Almost all the islands we went to had some sort of a little medical facility that you could get first aid and whatever. Seasickness is something we got over real quick, and you just get what they call your sea legs. And once you got your sea legs, then you're pretty impervious to it. Now, we were on Hawaii for an extended period of time, but we were, you know, sailing between the islands. So we never really got totally not used to being on the boat.
Right.
And the movement of a boat. So it wasn't an issue. Now, we did have one crew member at one point. They have what they call no-see-ums. They're little tiny fleas type of things. And they will get you an infection real quick. And that can be very, very dangerous. And he got so sick, and with that, we ended up having to fly him back.
Really?
Yeah. He just could not get better in the tropics.
You're out there for, obviously, at this point, you're out there for several months, probably almost a year that you were not. What are you doing money-wise?
Well, before we left...
They didn't have ATMs back then, did they? And where are you going to stop for an ATM?
Yeah, exactly. First of all, keep in mind, there's really nothing much to spend money on. Like I mentioned earlier, we did a lot of trading with the Islanders for things that we needed, you know, food. Water was very scarce in some places, but they would share their water with us so we could, you know, supply the boat. Most of our trips between the islands were just, you know, 2, 3, 4 days. So it was never an issue. Yes, periodically I did have to wire ahead and get money sent to us at the next, you know, island.
Right.
And have some cash, but not a big thing.
What did you do for protection at any point? Did you have any kind of a weapon on board to be able to protect yourself and your family?
We did. I had a pistol on board and a rifle.
Yeah.
But we really didn't have much in the way of issues. Mostly petty theft, where the Islanders would see us hanging our clothes around the boat at night.
Right.
And they would sneak up and grab a pair of shorts or maybe a shirt or something. And then the next day we'd see them walking around on the island with one of our shirts on, you know.
Okay, where'd you get that? I wonder.
Well, I told the kids, I said, you know, don't even say anything, you know, just
let them have it.
Be proud. They will prize that shirt that you voluntarily gave up.
We need to take a short break. We're talking with my friend Captain Richard Chesbrough about his trip around the world on a boat. Back in a minute.
We're back in 5, 4, Q Terry, 2, 1, you're on. You're listening to the Terry Saul Show on KSLM AM and FM, brought to you today by the Lule Group.
Welcome back to the Terry Saul Show. We are talking with my friend Captain Richard Chesbrough, who is in the middle of the Pacific Ocean someplace.
Pacific Ocean, correct.
With his kids and his wife, his former wife. You were getting ready to cross the equator when we were talking. And when you do that, there's some type of a ceremony, what's called polywogs to shellbacks. What is that?
Well, I believe that goes way back into the early maritime days. Maybe it started in Great Britain, but I know the U.S. Navy has that ritual that they do every time they cross the equator. And it applies only to the sailors on board that have never crossed the equator as of yet on a boat. But they spend hours putting this whole thing together, and it's really hilarious.
Is it like a party or something?
It's like a big party.
Okay.
Almost like a, what do they call that ceremony when somebody is going into a campus fraternity?
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's that sort of a thing, except this goes on for hours. Some of the highlights is you got to put all your clothes on backwards. You got to, you can't crawl, you can't walk on the deck. You have to crawl, and you have to crawl like a crab, you know, kind of backwards,
right,
sideways.
Right.
Fun stuff like that. You got to kiss the royal belly of whoever the fattest person is on the vessel. And of course, on a big Navy ship, I'm sure they got a cook or somebody that's got a big old belly
on
it. And they grease it all up with lard or whatever, and you got to kiss the royal belly. On our boat, I was the guy with the belly, so not that I had a big belly, but the kids all had to kiss my belly. You know, we dressed up in costumes and just really had some fun, fun things.
So what was your typical day like? What, when you're out at sea, you would get up at what time?
Well, like I say, you're never, you know, you sleep in watches. So depending upon what your watch is, you know, your morning may start at any hour. Could be the middle of the night. It could be the middle of the morning. It could be mid-afternoon. So
so you never really have a day off, do you?
You never have a day off. Nope. You're constantly sailing 24/7.
Okay. And I'm looking through some of these photographs that you took. You took hundreds of photographs. It's just amazing to look at some of the stuff there. And I'm looking at this one thing there where there's just looks like hundreds of bananas. Were bananas something that you guys enjoyed?
Like I mentioned earlier, whenever the islanders saw a boat coming in, they would kind of adopt you.
Yeah.
And in fact, often whoever was the breadwinner in the family would either quit working for the time that you were there so that he could kind of be your tour guide.
Really?
And almost always we could find somebody that spoke broken English, you know, on the island. So that person would kind of hang around with us whenever we needed to go shopping for anything. But whenever you left, it was always very sad. They were sorry to see you go. You know, I mean, we had to keep moving. And but they would bring gifts. And one of the easiest gifts they could bring would be a whole stock of bananas. And, of course, bananas will get ripe all at the same time.
Right.
So, and you know, when they're green, you can actually eat them like a plantain, you know, where you just cut them and you fry them, you know, like potatoes.
So you're,
but a lot of those bananas got thrown overboard.
I bet.
You know?
Yep. So you're south of the equator. You're on this 47-foot boat with your wife, your children, and one crew member. Who knows where you're at? I mean, away from the boat, does anybody, does the government know where you're at? Do you have, you don't have to have like any kind of a flight plan or anything, do you? You're just out on your own? And
Not back in those days. Today, maybe it's a different story.
So nobody knew where you were at then?
We did have a single sideband radio. We could get messages sent back home to family members as to where we were, because I knew my parents were definitely plotting on their maps of the South Pacific.
Sure.
You know, well, here's where they are, here's where they are going next, and that sort of thing. That was wonderful. And Ian Calvert, our South African deckhand, was a ham radio operator.
Okay.
And he had his own radio with him. Boy, with a ham radio, you can speak to anybody anywhere in the world.
Yeah.
It's incredible.
Yeah.
And so that came in handy as well.
Was on this journey, obviously you're south of the equator there. Did you ever go through any hostile areas there? I mean, there's pirates out there.
Well, not in that part of the Pacific. We didn't find anybody that was that much of a concern. Now, on our second big trip, when we used the different boat, you know, the Lady Free, there we were in much more some dangerous areas and countries.
Was that a bigger boat?
It was a much bigger boat. It was a 102-footer.
Wow.
But a whole different part of the world. You know, we were sailing in a lot of South America and Central American countries. There we had some more serious attempts.
Like what?
Well, when we were in Panama, we were going through the Panama Canal, and Noriega was in charge, was the president of Panama at that time. And he decided to take any weapons he could get off of anybody that was going through the canal. Small boats. That's the only way you get away with it. So they took all of our guns away from us, supposedly, just while we went through the canal. And then on the other end, we would get them all back. Huh, never happens. You know, you never get your weapons back.
What? How did that work? When you got back, you say, hey, where's our weapons? They go, I don't know.
Well, they you know, they always had an excuse. Oh, well, they'll be here any time now.
Yeah.
And all they would do is wait you out until you had to leave. You know, you just had to get going. So you just left your weapons behind.
So going through the Panama Canal, how long did that take you to go through there?
Oh, you do it all in one day.
It's a one-day thing?
It's a one-day trip, yeah.
Do you have to pay to go through there?
No. We would just tag along with the ship. As the ship was going through, they would slide one or two yachts in with the ship.
Okay.
So we kind of shared the same. And the ships were paying the big bucks.
Right.
And we were just kind of hitching along for the ride. Because the, I take it back, it seems we've been through about four times through the Panama Canal. But I think the last time we did have to pay a small fee. But it was like $100 or something,
yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
And this was still when the United States controlled the canal, you know. But the Panamanians had their own idea of how to collect money out of people, you know.
So you took, obviously, a ton of photographs. And I'm looking through some of these photographs there. Did you people ever wear clothes?
What page are you on?
I'm looking at the dates. It says, okay, this one here is May 10th of 1974. And as I'm going through there, you know, okay, it could be warm and stuff, but...
Well, when you get around the equator, yes, it's very warm most of the time. So bathing suits or cutoffs was the kind of the rule of the day.
I'm also looking through these pictures, and I don't know what they're called, so forgive me for acting like an idiot here, but those big old ladder things that go up on the sail, and your kids are at the top of those things.
Oh, yeah, they're like monkeys climbing around in the rigging. And
is that what it's called, rigging?
Well, they're ratlins. They call them ratlins.
Ratlins?
Yeah.
Okay.
Like rat lines.
Right.
And but that's the ladder that you climb up between the stays.
Right. Yeah, and that's what I'm looking at here.
Yep.
And it looks like, you know, two fairly young children are almost at the top of this thing.
Oh, yeah.
Now, one of them...
They love that. Is
hanging on for dear life. One of them here is like... show off, waving, hey, I can do this with one hand, Dad. And this one's going, I'm not even moving.
Yeah, the show off one is my daughter, Lori, and she was definitely the daredevil of the three of them. Still is to this day.
I know Lori.
You know
she
Lori.
Still is. Okay. I mean, they had their jobs to do as well, right?
They did. They did. And they stood watches just like my wife and I did. I mean, we never had the kids just by themselves standing a watch. We always had an adult. Either myself or Gay or Ian, our deckhand, with one of the three kids. Oh, I just turned to the page about the coconut crabs, which was, that was kind of exciting. This is the largest crab in the world. It's called a coconut crab.
Yeah.
And they're on those little islands. Remember I was talking about the Tuamotos?
Right.
One of the islanders took us over to show us how they catch coconut crabs. And it was really...
They're kind of weird-looking things, aren't they?
They are, and they've got one huge claw, and they got one small claw. And that huge claw literally can crack a coconut in half.
Really?
It would also take your arm and break your wrist or whatever if it ever got a hold of you.
And they weigh about, what, 5 to 7 pounds or so?
I don't know exactly, but probably that would be a good guess of what they do weigh. But the interesting thing is when we went with the islanders to catch them, they have holes right close to the palm tree. If there's no coconuts that have fallen out of the palm tree, the coconut crab will go up and get one and chop it down. And,
really?
Of course, they crawl up the tree. So the only way you can catch them is you watch to see one of them climb up a tree, and then you get around close to the bottom, and you'll have a sack to catch the crab with. And you got to be really fast. Because when they hit the ground, boom, they go right down their hole, you know, and get underground.
Okay.
So what you do is you tie a string with some turf in it, like grass, around the as high up the trunk of the coconut tree as you can, so that when the crab is coming down, they come down kind of backwards and sideways, and they're not looking. But when they feel that grass thing there, they figure, oh, I'm at the bottom, so they let go, and they fall the last 5 or 6 feet, whatever, you know, height you can reach.
Right.
If they land on their feet, chances are you're not going to be fast enough to catch them before you lose them. But if they land on their back, you got a good chance because it takes them a while to flop back over. We were there, four of us were there on the island. We caught two coconut crabs for the entire day. That's how difficult it was.
Were they good eating ones?
Oh, my God, they're so good.
Yeah.
You know, it's like in Florida, they have the stone crab. Yeah. And you just take the one shell and you throw the body back in and it grows another shell. This is the same way with the coconut crab. But the islanders there, the meat inside the body of the crab is just as good as the claw. So they just kill the whole crab, which is a shame because they don't perpetuate that well. And so they were getting hard to find.
Did you eat a lot of, were you doing a lot of fishing?
Constantly. We constantly had a fishing line trailing behind the boat. And we would catch mahi-mahi and...
What is that?
As you got close, it's the dolphin fish. Oh, my God, that's good eating.
Yeah.
It's very, very soft meat type of a fish. I know your wife, Patty, likes catfish.
Yeah.
This is even better than catfish, but it's a very similar type of texture.
We'll be on a boat going looking for it.
Or you could get it in restaurants. Yeah. Just ask for mahi-mahi. Yeah.
Mahi-mahi. All right. Hey, Kevin, we need to take a short break here as we're running out of time here. I've got so many more questions to ask you on this thing here. I'm going to take a short break. We'll be back in just a couple of minutes. You're listening to The Terry Saul Show. Stick around.
You're listening to The Terry Saul Show on KSLM AM and FM. Brought to you today by the Lule Group.
Hey, this is Terry Saul, Saltissimo. You know, when it comes time to move into a new home, it's time to consider Don Lule Homes. The Lule difference is simply setting the bar for quality service in Salem. Find out today about custom-built new home. Don Lule Homes offers open floor plans, quality craftsmanship, and over 50 years of excellent experience in new construction. Beautiful homes are coming soon. Call today and ask for Erica at 503-428-6992. Don Lule Homes.
We're back in 5, 4, Q Terry, 2, 1, you're on.
You're listening to The Terry Saul Show on KSLM AM and FM, brought to you today by the Lule Group.
We are back. We're talking with Captain Richard Chesbrough about his trip on a boat around the world that he took his family and they took off. You used to go scuba diving a lot of times, didn't you?
I did. I did.
Take your son with you?
I was a licensed diver. Took all kids with me.
How do you become a licensed diver? I didn't know that you had to have a license to be a diver.
Well, if you want to rent dive equipment, you know, like scuba tanks and whatever, you have to show that you've been trained on how to handle that kind of equipment.
Didn't you have your own?
I had my own, but I didn't have a compressor, an air compressor to refill them.
Got it.
So I would have to go into a dive shop. And they always ask you, you know, do you have your card? NADA, the National Association of Divers. So I would have to show them the card. Then they would fill my tanks for me.
Okay.
Fill them with air.
I'm not going to get into this too much, but your wife sure didn't wear much clothing, did she? I'm looking at photographs here. And
I hope she's not listening, but no, she...
Not this wife.
Oh,
wife
no,
number
not this
one.
Wife.
No. Wife number one. But there's a lot of pictures in here that she kind of misplaced her top.
Yeah, she had a habit of doing that.
Oh, well.
And it didn't seem to bother anybody, so...
Not bothering me.
No.
So let's talk about the diving part. You said that you took your son, actually you took all the kids and went diving there. Did you ever have any issues or anything when you were doing that?
We did two types of diving. Snorkeling we did the most of, because that was just a lot of the
and
water.
And you're just kind of skimming across the top, right?
Well, you swim on the top, and if you see something interesting on the bottom, and if it's only like 10 or 12 feet deep, you can hold your breath that long and go down and pick it up. We were collecting seashells for my daughter, Lori, and oh my God, she ended up, by the time the 2 years were over, she had one heck of a collection.
I bet.
And we would snorkel for that, no sense wasting air. The primary reason I used the air tanks was if we had to really go deep. Like one time I went down for some black coral, and that was well over 100 feet deep. Or if I had to do...
You went down by yourself?
I went down by myself. Not
well,
a good
that,
idea, but I did.
That's not very smart.
There was nobody else around. I just wanted to get a piece of black coral, that's all.
Yeah.
And I figured, well, you know, I can do that. I've been down over 100 feet many, many times.
Okay.
On my 75th birthday, I went to the Bahamas and was diving on some sunken ships. And we were down, about 90 feet on that dive. Yeah. Anyways, getting back to the diving trips, a lot of times we would snorkel when we were anchored in a small harbor. And I'm thinking like in the islands of Tahiti.
Okay.
Very seldom could you tie up at a dock. So you had to drop the anchor out in the harbor. And you could either, you know, row your dinghy ashore or you could swim. Very often, we would just put on our goggles and our snorkel, and we'd snorkel the shore. The boat was anchored in about 30 feet of water, and we thought nothing of it until this one day we were about halfway, and it was probably, a good 100 yards to get to shore from where we were. And I had the three kids with me, and we're all swimming along together, enjoying watching the coral and the small fish swimming around, when a whole school of sharks swam right underneath us.
Oops.
The kids are all looking at me, and of course they have their goggles on, but I swear their eyeballs eyeballs were almost as big as the goggles, you know. And they're like, what do we do now, Dad? You know, and I just told them to be calm. Don't keep flip-flopping your feet, you know, just stay still. Make believe they don't see us and we don't see them type of thing.
Did,
I don't know whether they saw
close?
Us or not. Well, they were about maybe 15 feet below us.
That's close.
So, it was close.
Yeah.
But they obviously didn't pay any attention to us because they just swam by. And there was about six of them to three of us, you know, or to four of us.
Ouch.
And we were too far to go back to the boat and too far to get to shore. We were right in the middle.
Yeah.
So we would have been easy pickings. But
remember the television show with Lloyd Bridges, Sea Hunt?
Oh, yeah.
He always he always had a knife on his leg in case he needed one. Did you have anything?
We had a knife on our legs. Absolutely. Against a big shark that's, yeah, you know, six, 8 feet in length, useless.
So when you got to shore and the kids could talk, what'd they say? Dad, did you see that?
Oh, before we even got to shore, they were talking, you know, when obviously the shark swam one way and we was going the other direction. We decided from there on out, we weren't going to snorkel all the way to shore, especially when it was so far. We would take the dinghy and stay inside. Okay. We had another occasion where we also had a rubber raft on board. I was going over to a ship that offered us some fuel, and it was a French ship. As I come alongside of the boat, they have one of those ladders that goes up the side of the ship, and I'm holding onto the ladder, helping my kids, you know, up because they just wanted to see the boat. And all of a sudden, this hammerhead shark comes right up between our dinghy and the boat.
And the hammerhead's a pretty good sized shark, isn't it?
Oh, he was huge.
Yeah.
I don't know how big this guy was. Had to be 10 or 12 feet.
Yeah.
And all I could see was that big head, you know, with the eyes way down the end. They hang around ships in harbors simply because of the garbage they throw over the side.
Right.
And it's easy pickings for them. It's something to eat. So he was just curious as to what was going on. And the kids had already gone up the ladder. I decided, I think I'll just stay right here and make sure that this hammerhead doesn't eat up my dinghy or something. Because I was holding on to the ladder. So
my dinghy isn't what I'd be worried about.
At any rate, it all worked out fine. He finally got bored and swam off slowly off. And the kids were really upset that they missed the adventure of having a hammerhead that close to us.
When you got back home, I mean, you said this was a two-hour journey originally?
2 hours.
I'm sorry, two years.
Yeah, that's okay. Close to
hello.
2.5 years.
Yeah. 2.5 years there. When you got back and you finally ran into your in-laws and your parents and stuff, were they going, where the hell you been for the last 2.5 years?
Well, we were writing letters back and forth. The only negative part of the whole trip was my wife came down with a tropical disease towards the end.
I want you to tell that story. We only have about 2.5 minutes left, but I want you to tell that story because it's a fascinating story, I thought.
She caught a meningitis infection on a little island called Niue, which was a New Zealand protectorate. But it's very serious. We didn't know that at the time, but the New Zealand government was quite aware of it. But they had never had a living survivor. Usually you were dead within 3 days.
That's how fast
this thing hits.
Yeah, yeah.
We didn't realize that's what she had until much later. But she spent almost 3 months in intensive care at New Zealand hospital that we were in. I still have a soft spot for New Zealanders because they were just so marvelous through the whole thing. But she survived. They waived all the expenses of all of her medical care and everything that we had there in New Zealand. Totally, she was in the hospital over 6 months. She had no feeling on the left side of her body after she came out of the hospital and was still very weak from it. But all's well that ends well. And like I say, she was the first survivor of that particular disease.
Has she had anything since then?
No.
Nothing at all?
No. She gradually got her feeling back and got back to good health. Still alive today, you know, doing just fine.
That is simply amazing.
Well, and I learned a lesson, too. I had such a hard time getting her out of the islands on an airplane, and we went to Fiji. None of the airplanes would carry her simply because of the disease, because she was slipping in and out of a coma constantly. But we registered our boat as a government boat. It's called documentation, like Lam McQueen is a documented vessel.
Okay.
As such, you're treated as if you were a U.S. Navy ship. You know, it's the same kind of a qualification. I could have called the U.S. government, you know, the Navy, and demanded, because we were a documented vessel, that they come and get us. And I never even knew that until after we got out of this whole thing. And it cost me a lot of money, and, you can't imagine all that we went through.
Wow.
Trying to get her to a safe and qualified institution that could really help her and help her survive.
Well, Captain, we are, unfortunately, we are out of time, and... you're still down in south of the equator. I still got 1,000 questions to ask you. So,
oh, I'd still like got to a lot you, of islands we haven't gotten to yet
if,
either.
If you could, if you could come back again, and we could maybe finish up from south of the equator, and figure out where you're headed to next, because I'd love to hear from you and finish the story. I think it's fascinating.
Be happy to.
All right. Thank you, Captain.
My pleasure.
Real quickly, what's the phone number?
Phone number, 503-371-1103.
You know, I used to know that by heart.
I
did. I knew it by
you
heart.
You didn't have that by heart.
Yeah. All righty, Captain. We'll talk to you soon.
You bet.
We're just about out of time for today's show. Remember, you can catch our show every Saturday at 10 a.m. and a replay Sundays at 6 p.m. right here on Salem's original radio station, KSLM. A reminder, if you missed any of today's show or would like to hear any of my shows, you can always hear a podcast on our official KSLM website at www.kslm.news or on my official website at www.terrysaul.com. If you would like to drop me a note, I'd love to hear from you. My email address is terry@kslm.news. We'll see you next time. Take care and be safe.
You've been listening to The Terry Saul Show on Salem's original radio station, 104.3 FM and 1220 AM KSLM. Today's show is brought to you by The Lule Group, featuring Lule's Car Connection, Don Lule Homes, and Teresa Lule's State Farm Insurance. That's a wrap. Thanks, everybody. Good show.
Bye, everybody.